Hello, this is Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we're about to start a conversation with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski in his 20th year as president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, just named chairman of President Obama's Advisory Commission on Educational Excellence for African Americans, Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of the Year. But he doesn't care about all that. He cares about other stuff, which we're going to get to. So stay with us, but turn this over to WEA Traffic for Metro Traffic and come right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
Before we start a conversation with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, I want to remind you that support for the Mark Steiner Show comes from the Maryland State Education Association. The Maryland Dream Act makes sure kids who graduated from a Maryland high school and whose parents have paid taxes for at least 3 years can pay in-state tuition. Investing in education of our kids benefits our state, our economy, and the young people who will get a shot at achieving their dreams. No matter which way you want to go, on November 6th, voters get to determine if some of our Maryland students get to seek a higher education. It's important to vote. More information about ballot question 4 can be found at educatingmarylandkids.org. And now we're here with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, president of UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Freeman, good to see you.
It's great to be here, Mark.
Great to see you.
Thank you.
So it's funny, we did this just at that piece on the DREAM Act, and you caught a lot of flack recently for coming out from some quarters.
Sure.
For supporting the DREAM Act. And why did you? Not catch the flack, but why did you come out?
I came out, as I said, that morning when we had a press conference on our campus. 50 years ago, adults stood up for me, and it made all the difference in the world in that 1963 period with the Children's March. And people from around the country of all races said, we need to support our children. And my point was, how could I not? How dare I not stand up for children? These are our children. They deserve an education. And I needed to do that. I did the right thing.
I think you did, too.
Yeah, sure.
And you were a friend at the time, of course, as many people know, some people do not, that you were 12 years old in Birmingham, Alabama,
mm-hmm.
were part of the Children's March,
yes.
was arrested.
Yes.
You were in jail for a week.
Yes. 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 5 difficult days. I learned a lot. Dr. King said what we were doing would change a lot of things, that it would have an impact on kids yet unborn. And so for many of us, we have seen the world change dramatically. If we've been able to get an education, life is very different from what it would have been if we had not. But for children who've not gotten that education, things haven't changed that much. And that's the challenge we face, to help them to get that education, all of our children.
And it's going to be a very tough thing for people to deal with, but I think that it's a really critical issue. I've been interviewing a lot of the Dreamers,
mm-hmm.
and I've been interviewing a lot of young kids, black and white kids, who support the Dreamers,
yes.
which I found
yes.
really interesting.
Sure,
because
sure.
we also want to make this somehow into a racial divide.
Right, no, you know? No. And I think my students of all races, many, many, were very proud that I took that stand, and I got amazing letters. I got mean-spirited notes from people who have a different point of view, and I always say we can always differ. There's nothing wrong with that. That's the American way. I think there's a way to differ, to not become personal. But what's important to me is that as I go around the country, there are many people from both parties who support these kids getting an education. You notice the Baltimore Sun was wonderful in its editorial of saying the governor of Texas, and I agree, that children need to get an education. So we have people from different backgrounds, different points of view, but I think in places like Texas, the reason the governor would agree is he sees that the economy of our country will depend on how well-educated citizens of all kind are. And either people get an education and can get a good job, or they won't be able to contribute, and then we end up paying for them. So, I mean, for self-interest reasons, in addition to the moral reasons, we want as many American children as possible to get as much education as they can.
If you want to join us here?
I'm very, of course, you know, I always got questions. Dr. Hrabowski,
yes.
I told someone in my office that I would be interviewing mm-hmm, tonight, and mm-hmm. she got almost giddy. And because she said that you, her husband is a student on your campus, and that you have created an environment mm-hmm. where she has been there to visit him, meet him, and they have seen you walking around the campus or
yes.
sitting around the campus. And students come up and sit down
yes.
and start talking to you.
Yes.
And her amazing thing, in a world that Baltimore seems so segregated, mm-hmm. Baltimore County, that people don't interact together. She said that she was amazed that you have created this environment where it's not that people are colorblind,
right, right,
but that people are all students there trying to achieve excellence.
Yes.
How do we translate that environment to other places around the country where we see higher education is oftentimes, everyone is so stressed, tests, papers, work, trying to excel, loans, that there is a, I don't want to call it segregation, but there is a separation. How have you created that? And how do we create higher education that brings people together?
It's an excellent point. I think, you know, people give me a lot of that credit with all these awards. It's my colleagues. You know, from the beginning, UMBC was the first institution in our state, founded actually in 1963 of all times. First students coming in 66 when kids of all races could come there and study. Now, getting in the same environment doesn't mean, which is very significant.
Yeah.
It really is.
That's right. That's right.
So we call ourselves historically diverse. We've always had students of all races. Yeah. I think the challenge, my colleagues would agree, has been to create an environment that encourages students of all races to get to know each other. In my first speech every year, I say to new students, get beyond your comfort zone. Don't just know people from your county or your state or your race. Get to know people who are different because the world is filled with all kinds of people. That's why I say we can disagree on all kinds of things. We have to learn how to disagree agreeably. We can have different points of view, think it through, listen, without either becoming personal or mean-spirited, because the best of the American way is just that. We learn to disagree with some civility. This is what we need to focus on. And on our campus, interestingly enough, as people get to know each other, they realize they all bleed. They all are frightened in one way or the other. They all are dealing with issues involving parents. And I think the fact that we have students from 150 countries also helps. We come to appreciate what it means to be American, what we have as a country, the kinds of advantages we have. We see how kids come from Russia or from China or from Nigeria and how amazed they are at what the American way really is, the fact that they can get an education, that kids go to college, you know. And what you hear from them is, they want to take advantage, full advantage of what America has to offer, whether they stay or not. And it helps, I think, my students to appreciate both the meaning of hard work, of discipline, but of also how people who first come to this country see it as a dreamland in many ways, in a way that we take for granted. If we've been here all our lives with all our problems, we don't realize what a great country it is. We have our problems. We have to do much more to help poor children. We all know that. But it has shown that human beings can come together from different backgrounds. So the key is that faculty and staff work to present the case to people. We have different ways of putting people in groups randomly, not by race, not by where they're from, but rather randomly so we can mix it up. And that's my message. Get beyond your comfort zone. I think we have to do that in the entire country. We need people to see people and hear people different from themselves and to learn how to listen to different perspectives, whether they come from a different religion or a different part of the world, and not to assume that our way is the only way.
And folks, we are going to go to the phones here at 410-319-8888. Dave Vaughn, you're the first caller up on the west side. We'll come to your call, and I just ask this question, and we'll go right to your question for Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. But, you know, okay, so I'm trying to get this in one, make this coherent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that you have gotten these prizes, the Heinz Award, the Carnegie Award, totaling close to $750,000, which you then probably didn't keep.
Right, I gave it to the university.
Gave it to the university, which is pretty amazing.
Because we all got it. I mean, I got the awards, but I was representing the university from my perspective. Anything that I have accomplished is a result of what we have all accomplished. It is a community of people working together. It's so important. That's not just saying that. That's the truth. Faculty, staff, and students.
Now, I believe that, and I believe that you believe that, and I believe many people around you believe that. However, something has been accomplished at UMBC that has not been accomplished at many of the public universities or many of the universities, period, which are the numbers of African-American kids and kids of communities of color who graduate, go on to graduate school in the sciences, engineering that you push so hard that you want to see happen. And we'll come back to the point a little while that UMBC is not just a science school.
Right.
You have to get
you
on the arts.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
We built a brand new big building, which we'll talk about
arts
as well.
And humanities, that's right.
So we'll come back to that.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
We'll come back to that. But the question is, I know there are no templates that you can just stamp in any institution.
Sure.
But there's something missing.
Yes.
And the
yes.
question is, what's the conversation we have to have? What do people have to start thinking about how to recreate that in more institutions?
Yes.
Not just in UMBC.
Yes, yes. Let me say, first of all, let me give credit to HBCUs. I am a graduate of Hampton, a very proud graduate of my beloved Hampton. Jackie and I met there, and it was a wonderful experience. What did it do?
She married you.
So I am very appreciative that I had that opportunity. I must tell you, though, for a long time, she just kept saying, let's be buddies.
That's right.
So I tell young women, just be buddies with them first, all right? Get to know them first. Here is the point, that what we saw there was that faculty really cared, and they pushed us and loved us. And what I see at UMBC, that's the same thing, is exactly that. And I should give credit. A number of HBCUs are doing well in that area, too, of producing kids who become scientists. I think the point is that we need to look at best practices, whether it's a UMBC or an HBCU. What is it at the heart of success? It is that strong interaction between faculty and students and staff who care. I just chaired the National Academy's Committee on Underrepresentation in Science. People can look at the link. Because still only 2 or 3% of the scientists in the country are black and the same percentage for Hispanics. Here's the point. The places that are making a difference have thought about what it takes to redesign courses, to focus more on teaching and learning, to get students to work together, and to get students into the labs. And I think the campuses in this area are really working to do that. I think that UMBC has been very fortunate because we have faculty who are thinking innovatively about those issues. And when the new data come out concerning the last 5 years, having looked at it, I know we're leading the country in that area. But I want to give credit to Morgan. Morgan has historically done a wonderful job and continues to produce these
Absolutely
students
does.
Also.
Absolutely does.
By all means. So let me give them that credit.
You need to put more black engineers than any other institution.
That's exactly right. And they should be very proud of that.
Absolutely.
We are all very proud of them.
No, absolutely. I am as well. Mm-hmm. But I still want to come back to more specifics. Then, Devon, we're going to write to a deep, I promise.
Yes.
I mean, because well, you watch the Chicago teacher strike going on right now, right?
Yes.
And there are arguments on both sides of the strike, clearly.
Yes.
But some of the things that teachers are doing, and I've interviewed a lot of people in the union, people support the union.
Right.
And they really are not sitting there asking for more money. They're asking, though that's part of it. They're saying we have to the Greek School Day and bringing more diversified teaching and languages and art and music into the schools and that. And building the schools where the classrooms are smaller, people are struggling with how you get there.
How
you get to the place where you don't have 50 kids in the classroom.
Right.
In especially poor urban schools.
Yes,
white, Native American, Latino, whoever it is.
Sure.
Because that's part of the answer.
Yeah, I agree. I really think people have to understand the issues. And there are no quick fixes, number one. Number two, it seems to me so important that we look at ways of giving children the amount of attention they need. All right. Number three, they're right. We need to extend the day. Number four, we have to find ways of getting families to help reinforce what the teacher does during the day. The books that my colleagues and I wrote on raising smart black kids talk about the fact, for example, parents should never talk about a teacher in front of a child. And yet it happens all the time. Because if the child hears the parent saying something different from what the teacher is saying or being dissatisfied with the teacher, that child, I don't care what race, that child will just make a greater split between the parent and the teacher. And most important, I think we need to understand what it takes to help a child learn to read and think critically. And it does. It's so important.
Yes.
It really is. And, people hear us talking about STEM and science and technology. I'm a strong believer of having the arts in the schools. It helps to have that discipline. There's something about what the arts can do that can strengthen what we do in mathematics, what we do in science. There's a respect for the discipline required to play an instrument, what orchids are doing down at with the symphony. Amazing the kind of excitement it brings to the children. You want things that will engage the children. For example, children are bored in school. And I think teachers would say they need ways of bringing excitement to the work and getting them engaged in the work. And just a simple lecture and sit there will not get it.
I mean, okay, let's go to the phones. I could dominate this whole thing, but it wouldn't be fair. 410-319-8888. Dr. Freeman Rombowski is in the studio with us. Anthony and I are both in the studio together. It's Monday. And Devon in West Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes. How you doing, Mark and Anthony?
Welcome.
Hey, Devon.
How you doing, Dr. Rabowski? I have actually two questions.
Sure.
First, quickly, is that there is a burgeoning movement in academic policy debate on the high school and college level of an increase of students of color, you know, being successful at the highest levels.
Yes.
Particularly debaters who integrate a literature base that draws from the cultural identity of people of African descent.
Yes.
And one of the things that, and incidentally, in this region, in Baltimore and in the state of Maryland, some of the most successful black debate minds are in the area. And one of the things that we, you know, many of us have talked about is doing some kind of camp where we can start to institutionalize the development of the skills that led, you know, myself and many others to the highest levels of competitive debate success. You know, and academic policy debate being an activity that generally leads people to, you know, becoming lawyers, judges, you know, high power politicians, and so on and equipment. So I was wondering, to what extent would you be interested in supporting an effort like that? And I guess my second question quickly is, what role do you feel that one's cultural identity plays in the way that instruction and education is framed for people of color? Because I've always thought, you know, well, not always, but I've thought, you know, that, you know, in my own experience, that once I became aware of the role that my own cultural identity played in my lived experiences, it was, it allowed me to access certain ideas and certain issues in ways that I wouldn't have been able otherwise. And there are lots of, you know, academic scholarship that supports that. So I was just wondering what your perspective is on that.
First of all, congratulations on reading a lot. It's very clear that you're well read and that you think about these issues a great deal. I would agree that universities need to be as involved with children as possible in many ways. We supervise about 500 boys of color, mainly black, a few Hispanic, few poor white kids, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We make sure they're up in the morning, in school during the day, many on our campuses in the evening. And we're working with them on everything from their academic work to helping them develop a sense of self, to talking about their lives and their challenges. These are all first-time offenders, and many just don't have enough support at home. We're working to give support at the home and to work with families, grandmothers and others. And my students learn a lot, but these kids change from the first day they come to campus to 3 months later. For the first time, sometimes we see them smiling. For the second time, they're learning to listen to the different discussions and to ask good questions. We need as many opportunities for children to be around educated people as possible and to see people like themselves as well as others. And it's always interesting to me that when people first introduce me on my campus, the first thing some little kid will say is, they won't believe I'm president there, and they'll say, he's not president of this white university. And, you know, we say, well, there are all kinds of people here. Yeah, but it's white, they'll say. And then I'll have to show them my driver's license and my name card to prove I'm president. And then I say, you can have this job one day if you get the education. What is my point? That exposure makes all the difference in the world. And I do believe that it's good for children to learn everything from being able to debate to speaking well to listening carefully and, most important, to learning to think critically, and one can do that in many ways. Regarding cultural perspective, clearly people need to know themselves. There's no doubt about that. I am fortunate that one of my cousins was the chair of English at Morgan for 30-some years, and he was an expert in African-American literature from the 30s, first black to get a PhD from the University of Iowa in 1941. And he always talked about the need for children and people to be rooted in the black letters, to understand who Allison is. And I would say it helps for children to understand more and more about literature, about their history, about philosophy. I mean, all these areas are important, but most important, they need to be able to have a sense of self. And that comes from that historical perspective. But it also comes from having somebody who loves them and who tells them they're special. So all of that, it seems to me, important. There's no quick way to do that. It's an ongoing process for each of us.
You know, what you just said, how you responded to Davon, I was thinking about something you said to somebody, some interview you did, where you talked about growing up in your house where your family, your parents were college educated.
Yes.
Because they were inspired by Booker T. Washington, yes. Where their grandparents were to go to college, and that
good memory
began this
that's right.
This conversation inside that's your right. family. But you mentioned about how your mother and father approached it differently. But I think it was your mother who said, you know, would have you made sure you read all the great African American authors, mm-hmm. but also Dickinson.
Right? When I read Ellison, I also read Dostoevsky.
Right.
You know, and my mother would
punish Ellison read Dostoevsky.
Well, the point is that was her point.
Right.
That those great African American writers were well read broadly. They understood the human condition. They understood that Richard Wright was fascinated by some of the great writers, you know. And the key is that it gives greater perspective when you can put the African-American experience within the American experience and within a worldview. And so I think it's important to do both. I really do.
And the other side is important, I think, because we always seem to segregate this knowledge this way, at least on the literary and artistic mm-hmm. side, mm-hmm. that African-American literature – it isn't just for African American kids to study.
It should be
because it's at the heart and root of American literature.
Yes, yes,
do you know what I'm saying?
That's right. Well-read people study the different movements in our country. If you read this new book, The Warmth of Other Suns,
oh, it's an incredible book.
The sense of migration,
yeah.
of what happened in our country. When you study American history or African American history, they are inextricably linked. One can't understand the other. Each is a part of the other, with African-American history being a part of the American experience. You see, the migration of different groups to this country, the migration to the north of African-Americans. And we want our students, we want our citizens to have that broad sense of how we are all connected. It seems to me very important. It's important to appreciate one's own, but as we say at UMBC, we want you to see how your situation, your culture, your history will relate to that of other people, both in this country and beyond. I mean, we as Americans have to become far more globally educated. We have a language requirement. We want students to understand other cultures. You know, our students who come from other countries are always amazed that we Americans tend not to know other languages when they know two or three. We have
right.
to find ways of getting our students to study other languages and to have a greater appreciation of other cultures. Very important.
Go ahead, Ed.
There appears to be, and maybe I'm wrong, and you'll correct me, I know,
sure.
But there appears to be in higher education and academia these ongoing conversations about cultural studies
yes.
or gender studies.
Right.
And what we should do is yes. get people prepared to go into the workplace, to go into their careers, but right. to offer this other trail of thought or education yeah. oftentimes is wasted. And you'll hear people write about why we should do away with African-American
right,
studies,
right.
why women's
right.
studies is no longer
right.
a relevant
sure.
conversation to have on college campuses. Right. But you seem to celebrate that.
I know we celebrate those things, and it's because of our interest in understanding the truth and seeking the truth. I have a colleague in women's studies who is an expert on issues involving feminism and looking across cultures. And I've been reading her book and learning how little I know at this point in my life. You know, it seems to me that we want people to understand there's always so much more to know, whether talking about the perspective of women dealing with all kinds of challenges and ways in which they can feel isolated, or looking at what happens in the job market. I chaired the big grant we had, multi-million-dollar grant, called ADVANCE, which was focused on getting more women into science and engineering. And people say, well, why do you have these kinds of grants and why do you study these things? Well, MIT did a study several years ago and found that women were still being discriminated against, the best prepared of all women faculty in engineering at MIT. And NSF became very aware of the National Science Foundation of the need to look at those issues. And what was very clear was that there are policies and practices and institutions that discriminate against people as they're trying to raise families and other kinds of issues. And amazingly, we at first on our campus years ago, 10, 12 years ago, said, well, we don't have a problem with women. And people saw women over in science. Well, when we looked at the data, mm-hmm. what we found was mm-hmm. that only 12% of the tenure track faculty in science and engineering were women. And we had
wow.
to look at those policies. We had technicians, we had lecturers, and as a result of all of that, we were able to get this grant. We are now up to almost 40%. But it took really looking in the mirror, understanding the issues, understanding the ways in which men can overlook women in conversations, look to the man as the power. They're, you know, and what we found is that similarly, when talking about people of color and women, there are these issues. We can be biased without even realizing. We can be all good people and not realize they were all good people. It's just we tend to do what we've done before And I think that's the point. Just as it's not really a post-racial society, we still have challenges with regard to women. Look at the salaries. Look at the jobs that get more money. You know, if you go to a hotel, you know, my wife pointed this out to me years ago. You go to a hotel, there's certain jobs that men have, and you give them more money. If they're driving you in the car, and you give them a big tip. But women are serving, cleaning rooms and your toilets. You don't even think about what money they're making, and there's no tip. There are just ways in which we've seen things before that we've never, you know, why is it that the women are the ones doing the cleaning, and then why is it they don't get paid? These are questions we have to ask. And what I always say is enlightened people will say this, let me study this and see if I can understand the other person's perspective. Why are they saying that? Whether it's about my colleagues who are white looking at what's happening with kids of color on a campus, or it's about men and women. It's not about people being bad people. It's not about painting a certain picture or pointing fingers. It's about understanding others' perspectives. And that's what you get when you study these other areas. I mean, it seems to me the goal is to help one become broadly educated. That means learning about one culture and learning broadly about culture in general.
We'll take a very brief break and come right back with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. On our way to the break, I'll read this here. Excuse me. And Kevin, we're going to come to your call as soon as we come back. Join WEAA and Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, for a private reception and book signing for the upcoming release of The Silenced Majority, Stories of Uprisings, Occupations, Resistance, and Hope by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan, Saturday, September 29th, 4 to 5:30 p.m. at the UB Blake Cultural Center. Tickets include reception, copy of the book, and a photo with Amy and Dennis. Space is limited. Tickets are available at WEAA Studios or at 443-885-2075. That's 443-885-2075. More information at weaa.org. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. On our way back to our conversation with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. If you are a first or second-time home buyer looking for a home in Baltimore, they have help with down payments and more, your opportunity to find a house in this community. The Maryland Mortgage Program, 1-800-638-7781. The Maryland Mortgage Program, 1-800-638-7781. Anthony McCarthy and I are here in the studio. What did I change your name? I'm sorry.
That was a Boston little twist.
That was a little Boston twist there. Here with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, president of UMBC. And Freeman, you wanted to finish the thought on gender.
Sure. I think that the point is that a university should be a place in where people can talk about the sticky issues of the day.
Yes.
And, again, disagree with some civility and hear different perspectives. So in that program we have in Women and Gender Studies, the idea is how do we get men and women thinking about these issues as they become leaders, understanding what's happened historically, understanding ways in which people can be biased, and understanding it doesn't mean they're not good people. Mm. You know, for example, we learned with the advanced program that often a woman would be talking and a guy will just take over. Not even, he means no harm, but he'll complete a sentence and just go on right there.
My wife says that all the time.
You know.
That's right.
Or women, listen, sometimes a woman will make a suggestion and nobody hears it. The guy says it and all of a sudden it's embraced.
That's right.
We don't realize how much we do that. So I think we, as men, have a challenge to listen more carefully. The same thing is true with people from different groups. And so the point is we need to focus on, as a society, I think, teaching people how to hear different perspectives.
I'm going to go to the phones here, and one of your star graduates is now one of our producers.
That's right.
Has just written to me, UMBC is so on point, and when you just made your comment about women being heard, she wrote, my life. 410-319-8888. Kevin, you're on the air.
How are you this evening?
Very well, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate Dr. Freeman on his award, and as a co-founder of the STEM Academy, BDJ Academy in East Baltimore, Dr. Hrabowski was on board with the vision that we had to produce these math scientists and technologists, if you will.
Yes.
And Doc, I really appreciate your help, because at the very beginning, you saw the vision. You provided us with a number of role models from your campus for our young boys.
I appreciate that. And congratulations to you on the work you're doing. It is noble work.
Yes, sir. The question I have, if I can indulge you for a second,
sure,
is around retention and graduation rates, and particularly closing the achievement gap.
Yes.
And drilling down particularly to the African-American men. I'm sure that you're familiar with the Title III program.
Yes.
In which the president is looking to make sure that we have those science, technology, engineering, math, as well as make sure that we have the retention and graduation rates. But as you know, the dropout rate for students, just to drill down a little bit more deeper in terms of African-American males, at the secondary level is very high.
Yes.
And the dropout rate for many students who come to you or other colleges and universities because they're not prepared, the rigor, a lot of them end up dropping out after the first year.
Right.
More than 50% probably never graduate.
Yes.
So I guess my question to you, without really drawing a very bleak picture, is what do you think not only some of the challenges are, but what do you propose as a panacea, if you will, for closing this achievement gap for many of those students who are not getting the preparation at the secondary level to come to you to be able to get past the first year?
It's a great question. And let me say something that you'll appreciate. At this point, we're doing two things. We are working with a number of math and science programs at the K through 12 level to strengthen the skills of students, because the students we get are well prepared, just invariably. The only way we can have students from all over the world doing well is if we make sure our American kids of all races are well prepared. So there is no achievement gap for African-American freshmen on our campus. And amazingly, half of my black students on campus, it's about 14-15% of the black students out of 10,000, about 1,500 are African American, but half are male. We've really focused on making sure that we've got that kind of balance, and it's worked well. So our campus is not a good example of that problem, but I'm familiar with that problem for a lot of reasons, for the Upward Bound programs that we do have on campus as we work with children. And I spent 10 years at Coppin State. I have a lot of respect for Coppin State and what they do and the challenges they face, and saw some of these issues. And I work with places around the country. Here is the issue. If a student comes to college and still has to take developmental mathematics or remedial math, the probability of that student actually graduating from college is under 20%. We have seen that.
Wow.
And one of the things, as a math teacher, I can tell you is reading skills are as important as math skills, perhaps even more important. You see, if you give me a child who can read well, I can teach her to solve word problems, because word problems involve looking at the relationships among the words translated into an equation, and then kids can do equations, 5x plus 5 equals 15. Where kids, American kids in general, have a problem is in translating from the words to symbols, and most Americans are afraid of math. And so we have several challenges. Number one, how do we strengthen math at the elementary level? One of our challenges is that in this country, we teach algebra in the middle school years, and yet one doesn't have to have a math major to teach algebra here. And so the extent to which a teacher is really ready to do it depends on the high school preparation more than anything else of that teacher. And teachers do the best they can. I chaired the Math and Science Commission for our state 20 years ago, and the number one fear of many teachers at the elementary level was teaching mathematics. And these are good teachers. They just need support to strengthen their backgrounds, because to teach one thing, you've got to know more than that one subject. So to teach algebra, you need to know at least a semester of calculus and strong pre-calculus background. And most teachers have not had that. So we've got a problem at that level. What people don't know is that developmental math in college, in community colleges, and half of our American students are now in two-year institutions, whether it's two-year or four-year, developmental mathematics is the math you're talking about in the sixth and seventh and eighth grade. It's the same math. You're talking about pre-algebra and algebra. And so many kids don't know fractions and decimals and percentages and basic algebra. What we have to do is to strengthen teaching and learning at the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade levels. Now, when a kid hasn't gotten it, what can we do? I like what's happening in New York City. The New York City schools allow children to take the placement exams in about the 10th grade, at the community colleges in the City University of New York system to see if they would pass the developmental mathematics. If they won't, they can begin taking a developmental course while still in high school, so that by the time they finish high school, they won't have to take developmental math in college. And I think we're beginning to talk about that. We need much more emphasis on relationships between the high school, middle school, high school, and college, so that high school teachers look at that placement exam for college to make sure they are preparing a kid so that when that student finishes high school, we don't have to place them into developmental math. Because as I say, the probability if they start in developmental math is under 20%.
But what you just said, I can explore a little further. Thank you, Kevin, so much. I mean,
sure.
So what separates the way we approach math in the United States from the way the Europeans or Japanese approach math in their schools?
Sure.
I mean, what do they begin?
My sense is, and I've spent time in Germany, Japan, and some other places, there's much more support for strong math teaching in lower levels than we have right now. We've had grants focused on strengthening math teachers in the middle schools and bringing in people who have worked. I mean, the best teachers I find sometimes in math will have worked in a company as an engineer. Teach them how to teach kids, but they have all kinds of examples because the smart kid's going to say, when will I ever use this?
Right.
Why is this important?
Right. Right.
And we have not taught people that. And then, as some people would say, the way we teach is so traditional that it does not take into account how children learn. We've got to find ways of redesigning courses. I'll give you a perfect example. I'm working with the Marguerite Casey Foundation in Seattle. We were funding a program involving green construction in L.A., in Los Angeles. And what's amazing about it is that these were people working to get the GED. They were building a house. And they learned so much from about geometry, about algebra, from angles to squares to triangles. By the time they finished building that house, they had used so much math, they had no problem with the math and GED and no problem with the development of mathematics.
Exactly.
So more hands-on experiences where kids get a chance to move around and see how it relates could help substantially. But that means supporting teachers in redesigning courses so that we can engage the kids in the work and so they can see how the algebra relates to real life. That's what a lot of people are saying. When will I ever use this mathematics? That's the point.
I'm curious, Dr. Hrabowski, about Mark and I were talking in the first hour about these new dynamics of educating kids.
Yes.
Can we think out of the box without, I guess, blowing the whole box up?
Yes, yes, yes.
Is there a way to re-examine how children are learning?
Yes.
How teachers are teaching?
Yes.
But how – I want to ask you that. How do we broaden that conversation to bring new theories, new – ideas into the classroom and how we can express this and have the child retain it.
Sure.
That kind of gives them the tool to move forward. But then how do you ever, and this is less a policy question than trying to dig into your brain, do you ever get frustrated by all of the thought and thesis and all the questions and the movements about how do we do this better?
Sure.
How do we make this better? What will make Johnny read better?
There are two things
that we
to be
get
said.
Away from the basics of making sure Johnny
sure.
is
there are
reading.
Two things to be said. The old-fashioned way, and I do believe in phonics. I mean, the old-fashioned way of teaching reading. I'm just sorry. I think we can get something from all the methods. There's no doubt about it. But one has to learn how to read, and you learn to read by reading.
Right.
You just do. You have context, but you need to, from my perspective, the old fact, the combinations of ways. But here's the point. We learned this from first-year science at UMBC, and we're now doing it in the humanities and social sciences. Giving teachers a chance to try different approaches in chemistry, for example, and allowing them to look at how groups can work together using the technology and giving them problems to work on and solve together where nobody can sit back and be cool. Nobody can fall asleep. Everybody has a role. If you come to our, if you look on our web at umbc.edu at the Chemistry Discovery Center, you will see people laughing, fighting, I mean, in a positive way, just I mean, debating, problem solving, using the problems out of our biotech companies on campus, quite frankly. And the result has been a 50% increase in the number of kids in those who are getting a B or better. All right? It worked so well, we went in course redesign, it's called, to other areas, and now faculty are putting in proposals in the social sciences and in the humanities using, for example, technology in writing and groups working together. I'm a firm believer in building community among students. I think the students can teach each other with a faculty member facilitating that discussion. We tend to think too often in K through 12 and even in higher ed that when you work with somebody else, you're cheating.
Right.
But in real life, people have to work. Look at the two of you. You have to learn how to work with other people. It's not about a one-man show or a one-woman show. Right. And we can use that for group work. When we're working with these kids who come to our campus, large numbers of these children who come to our campus, and we've never had a major incident, two things. We give them discipline. We give them high expectations. We are very old-fashioned. You do not use profanity. You act like a young person in college when you're 12 years old and just going around. We give them time to play, and they rise to the occasion. They are amazed. It's amazing to me how people will rise to the occasion. But secondly, we're working to help them learn how to help each other. I want to see the average kid who's 14 helping a 10-year-old. You see, we don't understand that. That gives that child who's 14 a sense of responsibility. It says we believe in that child. I want to see high school kids helping middle school kids and middle school kids helping elementary kids. You see, it's amazing how a child will rise to the occasion when given responsibility. And so, but teachers have to be given support and flexibility to try those kinds of approaches. The National Science Foundation is coming up with more and more work that focuses on how children learn, different approaches, how we can use the technology to help, and it will make a difference. The other point, though, is we need to help families understand what they can do. You don't have to have a college education to help your child. You know, our books say this, right, beating the odds and overcoming the odds on raising smart black boys and smart black girls. All I want the parent to do is to show interest. How many problems or questions? I heard you saying this in the class. How many questions? I don't know the math, but how many questions did the teacher give you? 10. You've tried 8. Why didn't you do the other 2 questions? All right? Write down what you don't understand. Tomorrow, I'm going to ask you what the teacher said. All right? It's amazing how when a grandmother, a mother, father, somebody just shows interest, the child gets the point. Now, that may not help all families, but it would help a lot of families to understand it's not just the teacher's responsibility. It's very important.
And I think what you said about math is very critical because we have this thing, I want to be whatever it is I want to be in life, why is this subject important to me? Why is it important that I study literature?
Yes.
Why is it important I study music? Why is it important I understand math?
Yes, yes.
Because it has to do with grounding and making the whole human being.
It's so important. This gets us to the arts and humanities.
That's where I was going to.
I appreciate that. I was waiting for you to get there. I was waiting. Because people always are proud of the fact that we do well in science. But listen, I mean, our theater students, we have courses in Greek and Latin that are full at 8 in the morning. People want to understand other cultures, you know. But most important, whether talking about social sciences, arts, and humanities, we would say this. A well-rounded person, a well-educated person, has a grounding in the arts, humanities, and social sciences. Whether one is planning to go on into grad school in those areas or to go to law school or to become a teacher or an artist – or scientists, one needs to understand how to write well, how to speak well, how to enjoy a good book, how to ask good questions. And, you know, I've got a colleague, he's actually a former student who went to UMBC, went to public schools, went to UMBC, then he went to Hopkins. But he majored in something called interdisciplinary studies at UMBC. And he put together his own program involving philosophy and biochemistry and some literature.
Wow.
And he got into the Hopkins Medical School. He did well there. He trained under Ben Carson. He's now the chair of neurosurgery at Vanderbilt. And when he comes back to talk to my students, he says when he has to talk to the parents of a child who's brain damaged, it's not the biochemistry that helps him have the language, develop the language to use, the compassion. It's the humanities, what it means to be human. And when he says it to the kids, it's so important because students can think the techie part is what's most important. Yes, you have to know the science. And I'm a mathematician. Math is beautiful to me. But I will tell you that learning to appreciate literature and to read Charlotte Bronte, I mean, the Bronte sisters, or to understand Dickens or Thackeray, you know, as well as Dostoevsky and Ellison and Richard Wright, to be able to talk about books.
Yes.
Makes it be. And, I mean, to be able to play an instrument. You know, people say I had
you
all
play
these
piano.
Years. I play the piano. We were neighbors. You'd hear me playing. You know? And a range of music from Chopin to gospel, you know, to elevate the soul. You know, that's what we want students to understand, that the arts and humanities elevate the soul, the spirit. They teach us how to live. And it's so important. And it sounds trite, but you show me a person who has delved into this work, and I'll show you a person who understands what it means to be human.
So can you have every student, every person in America is not going to go to college.
No,
to get a
BA, exactly right.
MA,
yes.
PhD,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Many would AA, if the AA path is something that gets somebody to the skills to be a phlebotomist or whatever else.
Yes, yes.
That's,
yes.
It's a job it's
yes.
important to have.
Yes.
But the trouble is sometimes we think that okay, you can do that. We don't do enough of that, mm-hmm. unfortunately, at the moment. Mm-hmm. You can do that. But A, it's also it doesn't hurt to – it's also important to have those other skills inside of you. You can be a phlebotomist who
yes.
plays the piano.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yes, exactly right. And you know, the 55% rate that the administration, the president are talking about, that we want 55% of our American citizens with a college degree, that involves both the two-year and four-year degrees. Very important to say that everybody isn't going to want to go and have a liberal arts major. People mature at different points.
Right.
We know that fewer boys are going to college in general. Proportionately, we're down. Of all races, they're bored in school. It's not for them right now. I would argue, however, that there are certain skills they still need to have. When I worked to get several of my little kids I was working with in the inner city to an auto mechanics program at the community college, they loved cars, but they couldn't get past remedial reading and math. Mm. We still need to know how to read and think. If you look at what auto mechanics do these days, they are computer experts. They're
right.
reading, discussing. They have to learn how to ask good questions.
Right.
The same. So that high school background in those first 2 years, still, besides the technical part, will require this. I was talking to someone who has a lot of car shops, and he was saying his biggest problem is finding auto mechanics, that he cannot find people willing to do the training. And he shocked me. He said, what do you think an auto mechanic makes in 3 or 4 years? I had no idea. He said $100,000. And he can't find people to do the training. You know, I'm telling you, we at McCormick, I'm on the board of McCormick, and we're working to get people to come in to the jobs in the factories. There are people working in the factories out in Hunt Valley, wonderful people of all races who have been there 30 years in their 50s. They've educated their kids. They got stock options. These people are worth more than $1 million. Some have decided to go and get a degree in addition to that. But the two big issues, I mean three, I would say, making sure students have not been using drugs as a drug test. That's a big issue we have to deal with. You have to help people understand. You use drugs, you're not going to get a job. All right? Number two, learning how to read because you still have instructions when you're working in a factory, being able to think, okay? And number three, having the right attitude to get to work on time, to respect authority, to know how to deal with other people. These are the kinds of skills we have to teach every child to appreciate. And so I do think we need to broaden our thinking about post-secondary opportunities. That mm-hmm. It doesn't mean the kid can't later on. But, you know, you think about being a plumber or an electrician. Those are hard skills. It takes a lot to get there. Doesn't mean that somebody can make a living and take care of their families. Secondly, later on, if they want to go to college and get that, they still can do that. But we need to help people develop skills to get a job so they can live. And I'm sure parents would say, hey, get out of the parents' home. And
really?
Take care of
that. But it's important, I mean, because people, I think that's something we don't talk about enough. And we only have 3 minutes left here.
Yes.
We don't talk about enough in terms of education because we have this mythology about everybody having to go to college. It's the only path to success, and I think that's a huge mistake we're making for our children.
And I think we need to listen to our children.
And how we organize our schools.
And how we organize our schools. But we need, as we work to listen to students at UMBC, we have redone parts of the library because they said, well, you want us to work in groups, so why must we be so quiet in all parts of the library? Why can't we have food and drink? Why can't we move the furniture around? And so UMBC students are amazing. They actually gave us some of their money that they use for bands and things like that to match our money to redesign spaces that will allow them to work in groups and yes. to have the space. If you come out and you'll see, and they are moving. Education should be engaging. At any level, whether it's college
Amen.
Or, you know, I'm excited about math. I get goosebumps during math. But I also get goosebumps when talking about a short story. You know, we want people to be excited about education, about literature, about looking at a painting, you know. And it comes from leadership, from our faculty, from our teachers at every level. When you come to UMBC, we like saying the life of the mind is very active. You'll hear conversations about sticky all over the place. I mean, I just get goosebumps walking around campus.
We have to, unfortunately, end this conversation. First, thank you, Dr. Freeman Rabowski, for being here. Freeman, it's great
thank
to see you.
Thank you. It's great to be in Baltimore. It really is.
It's good to have all of us in Baltimore and have you in Baltimore. Anthony McCarthy, thanks so much for coming in on Mondays, co-hosting. I deeply appreciate you being part of this.
It's the best part of my week.
Thank you very much. On our way out of here, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. Let me just say this, that Urbanite Magazine announces closing. They've been our print partner here since 2008 when we moved our show and started this new life on our show. It's a huge loss for our community that we're losing this magazine that brings together. When you go to their events, it's one place every race in this community, all class levels, scientists, professionals, artists were in one place. I hope it gets resurrected. Tracy Ward did an incredible job with that magazine, and we're going to miss it, but you can still go to UrbaniteBaltimore.com and read them online. They're going to be there, so don't leave them out. They'll be there at least for another month and maybe more. And again, Urbanite Magazine, we're going to know you'll resurrect yourself, and we're happy to be your media partner for all these years, and we deeply will miss you as a journal in our community. I remind you all the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis, who graduated from UMBC, Mark Gunnery, and Bobby Marvin Holmes, who graduated from Morgan State University. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our interns are Shea Tyrell and Latrice Eddy. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, hear new additional interviews, and also find out information about our guests and the work they do, the links will be on our website at steinershow.org. And say it right now, Marsha Reeves Jews is coming up, but keep it moving. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.